Hello, everybody, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you, wherever you may be. We're back live. This is Bruce Ash, along with co-host Eb Wilkinson, welcoming you to this special post-acquittal State of the Union Smackdown, pitchers and catchers reporting for spring training, post-Biden edition of Inside Track. Wow, what a week. The president is acquitted. Super Bowl 51 crowns a new quarterback hero. Joe Biden crack up, and Democrats, socialists prove they either can't count or are really determined to cheat Bernie out of another nomination. Wuhan virus cases up to nearly 50,000. Both Vindemans shown the door and escorted out of the White House. 225,000 new jobs. U.S. productivity up the most in 9 years. The Arizona presidential caucuses started today right here in Tucson and Pima County, and Rush Limbaugh diagnosed with cancer. What a week. I very much hope you will all support our great Inside Track sponsors, Eb Wilkinson sitting across from me and Gary Imus at Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, a great company. Jamie and Gary Kipper at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, and the folks at Corazon Cabinets, Joy, Jennifer, and David. Now, each of these advertisers has been with Inside Track from the start. These are great companies you should do business with, and I really do mean what I say. I do business with each of them, and they are great businesses. Speaking of great local companies you should do business with, Corazon Cabinets is your locally owned wholesale one-stop source for high-quality kitchen, bath, and office cabinets, as well as design services. Do you have a home improvement project planned for the new year? Corazon sells quality J&K, Yorktown, and Conestoga cabinets, offers a great wealth of design resources also for your home. Call Corazon Cabinets at 488-2266 and schedule a visit to the showroom. It's an easy number, 488-2266. Tell Jennifer or Joy you heard this ad with Bruce and Eb on Inside Track and get an additional 5% discount on their already low wholesale prices. I mentioned just a couple of minutes ago, Eb, that the Arizona caucuses started right here in the Oro Valley area, Legislative District 11.
You were there.
Bill Maynard ran a great meeting, and they selected all their people. Not one bit of controversy, all of them Trump supporters. It was quite an event. Also, just a reminder from last week's show about a Tucson tradition, Reunion de El Fuerte. This big event is going on right now until 4 p.m. at Fort Lowell Park and across the street on the Adkins Steel property, as well as just on the northwest corner of Fort Lowell and Craycroft, where the old fort buildings are, the commissary and the quartermaster.
I drove by there. It's packed.
Yeah, great stuff.
But there's always room for more parking.
Yeah, and admission's free. There's food trucks. They played antique baseball this morning. They had Army Cavalry reenactments. There's a regimental band that plays, and Franzi had that music that they actually played.
It was playing as I drove by.
Oh, that's great. Just a wonderful, wonderful thing. Neighborhood tours and lots of free parking. My wife went there with our grandson, Bodie, and had a great time this morning. So if you get there, if you get an opportunity, stop there. It goes on until 4 o'clock, and you really should take advantage of it. It's a great Tucson tradition in its 40th year. John, let's go ahead and take our first break, and when we come back, we'll welcome Islamist expert Dr. Andrew Bostom. You're listening to Inside Track. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Inside Track. Thanks for tuning in. Our first guest today is physician and Islam specialist Dr. Andrew Bostom. Andrew Bostom, MD, is the author of the highly acclaimed, and this is a great book, it's in a second edition, The Legacy of Jihad, Islamic Holy War, and the Fate of Non-Muslims. I'm getting mixed up here. From Sacred Text to Solemn History and Sharia versus Freedom, The Legacy of Islamic Totalitarianism. Dr. Bossom has published several articles and commentaries on Islam in the New York Post, Washington Times, New York Daily News, National Review Online, American Thinker, PJ, Front Page, all kinds of sources. More on Dr. Bossom's book can be found on his blog. It really is, Andrew, more of a website, and it's awesome. I've been there. If anti-Semitism is an issue, and specifically Islamic anti-Semitism, is something you're concerned about, this site, Andrew, it's as good as any that you'll find anywhere. So you're doing good. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All right.
I didn't want to cut you off.
Yeah. Hey, well, yeah, I was on a roll sort of. So tell me, Annie, how did an epidemiologist become a scholar on anti-Semitism? Where'd you get the inspiration?
It was really 9/11. My upbringing and my wife's upbringing and education through medical school, we're all in New York. We moved to Rhode Island for residency, and we ultimately, relocated here since 1990. But our families and our roots were New York, and I was shocked at how naive I had been. And you're busy with your medical career; it's pretty all consuming. We were starting a family. And I just was frankly taken aback by the apologetic right off the bat between President Bush talking about a religion of peace and materials that I picked up in bookstores, popular materials. So I wound up reading books by people that I later came to learn were just avowed apologists. It was very disconcerting to me, and I just began to get more and more curious. And I have tremendous resources at my university affiliated library, and one thing led to another. I met some incredibly bright and courageous independent scholars, and you learn a certain method when you're a researcher and medical researcher, and those skills actually were very useful and very remarkably transferable to studying these problems, these questions.
So Alon Friedman, who's a colleague of yours, wrote about your book, "It is a desperately needed corrective to the amnesia, ignorance, and self-destructive denial of reality that currently plagues much of Western civilization and its Jewish community when it comes to Islam's historical treatment of Jews." Now, that's a pretty sweeping endorsement of your book and the work that you've been doing since 9/11, isn't it?
Yeah, and Alon was, he's a very, very honorable and fair person. And he put in the fact that, I was actually involved in his training. He's a junior colleague, very barely junior. And so he did put that in as a caveat to his review. But regardless, I twist his arm to write that review. The indictment, I think, regardless of whether those are Alon's words or someone else's, is deserved, unfortunately. And you go no further than the updated edition really, it rivets on data. I decided to go back to my roots and really focus on data, on contemporary data, and virtually all of it, which had emerged after the first edition of the book came out in 2008. And that's from the Anti-Defamation League. Now, I'm politically conservative, so much of what the ADL does and promotes, I find objectionable. But their methodology for determining the occurrence, the prevalence, in epidemiologic terms, of anti-Semitism, and the way they define it, it's extreme anti-Semitism, is unmatched. So very, very straightforward. What they do, Bruce, is they administer a questionnaire. It's evolved a little bit over the years, but since 2014, certainly, it's been stable. And it asks for 11, it queries each individual that they survey on their agreement with 11 anti-Semitic stereotypes. And then all they do is they set a pretty high cut point. They say you have to agree with at least six of these. So the majority of these stereotypes, and they're things like, you know, Jews have too much power in international financial markets. Jews have too much control over global affairs. People hate Jews because of the way Jews behave. Jews think they are better than other people. Jews have too much control over the U.S. government. Jews are responsible for most of the world's wars, which, by the way, mirrors something that's in the 5th Surah, 64th verse of the Quran. But at any rate, you actually have to be agreeing with all those stereotypes. Now, one could argue, you know, frankly, you shouldn't agree with any of them. I mean, they're stereotypes that are not universalisms. But anyway, so the ADL defines an index case of extreme anti-Semitism as agreement with the majority of those stereotypes. And then assigns, you know, how common that is, the gauges how common that is in all the countries that they survey. And very consistently what they find is that the 16 most anti-Semitic countries in the world are all from the Muslim Middle East, where the occurrence of that degree of anti-Semitism, again, extreme anti-Semitism, is anywhere from 74% to 93%. And now it seems to be tracking with these Muslim migrant populations that are now part of the so-called Muslim diaspora in Western Europe, and even more recently in the United States. So in the last two surveys that the ADL completed, the most recent one just being released this past November, was in Europe, anywhere from 50% to 55% of the Muslims already exhibit that degree of anti-Semitism. Again, extreme anti-Semitism. That's 2 to 3-fold higher than the non-Muslim populations in Europe, whether they're just lumped all together or the Christians are separated out. And then in the United States, the most recent survey that was done was the end of 2016 into the beginning of 2017. And this is a much more philo-Semitic country, largely, I would argue, because of the evangelical Christian population in this country overall. But at any rate, the background rate is a little higher than, you know, people might suspect. It's about 14% in the non-Muslims in the United States, but it's already 34% in the Muslim population.
So Andy, in January, you wrote an article for the Geller Report where you wrote, and this really is sort of, I think, the punchline. The Arabs think what Hitler did was a good thing because he freed them from the Jews.
This was interesting, Bruce. I wouldn't generalize even with the such high rates of anti-Semitism that obviously, you know, all Arabs don't believe that. But this was an interesting case study because it was a Muslim migrant, I believe, from Syria, brought under you know, Angela Merkel's, you know, last gas policy to do something about this problem that she imported, brought to one of these Holocaust visits to a former German concentration camp, a crematorium. Right. I think it was one run by the SS in the Berlin area. And this was his reaction to it,
right,
after being brought to ostensibly to rid him of these harsh anti-Semitic attitudes.
Well, and the killer is from the standpoint of the ADL and other such groups, they think they portray white anti-Semitism is the big danger. It really, I mean, the anti-Semitism on sort of a extreme basis is coming from Islamists who want to wipe out all Jews, who want to, as they say, wipe Israel off the face of the earth. Well, there's 8 million Jews living in Israel. I mean, if that's not a mass extermination sort of an event, I can't imagine what would be.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting how the ADL deals with their own data. I saw this in real time, and I captured the video. You know, Mort Klein, the American Zionist Association, is the only American Jewish leader of stature that has gone over the ADL's data in a critical way and presented it in public. And he did this at a hearing back on April 9th, which was, by the way, featuring white supremacism. And Mort wasn't having any of it because he understands that the problem is way beyond white supremacism, which is a problem, but it's almost a trivial problem compared to the problem coming from the Muslim community. And that's in the United States and globally. And so Mort presented the ADL data, including the data I mentioned about the 16 most anti-Semitic countries in the world. And the ADL is there. This senior vice president is there. Hershenhorn, I believe, was her name. And, you know, the way these hearings run, it takes a little while for her to respond to Mort. You know, they have to go through the whole panel, and the bloviating congressmen have to weigh in. So it's at least a half hour later, she gets back to Mort, and she's referring to the data. And she says, well, yes, we survey, vulnerable minority communities have a lot of anti-Semitism. And this is how insane you have to be. So in other words, the Muslims of Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Jordan, you know, these countries with the highest rates in the world, these are Muslim minority communities. They're virtually 100% Muslim communities.
Right.
Andrew.
And this is how they answer.
Yeah, Andrew, Eb Wilkinson here. Question, you talked about getting into this right after 9/11. How much did you know about Islam before 9/11?
Very, just bare acquaintance from some history courses, you know, that I had taken in college, you know, sort of history survey courses, a little bit in philosophy. Very, very little. It was a real, you know, it was a very intense amount of study that I had to do. You know, it's been ongoing ever since. So now it's consumed close to 20 years now.
So looking back at your history courses that you took in college, based on your research now, how accurate were those courses, or were they slanted towards the support the support of Islam?
I think it's gotten a lot worse. I think what I learned about, and even some fictional writings that I read as a kid about the Crusades, I can remember, were much more realistic. You know, they were kind of superficial, but they were more realistic. I did an analysis because I was a Regents Scholarship winner. That's really what launched me. I was a middle class Jewish student from New York. And I really cherish the Regents Scholarship. It's a merit scholarship for New York State residents. And I was appalled about 10 years ago when I went back and saw what they've done to the History Regents Scholarship exam for New York State residents. And this was just blatant Islamophilia and bashing Christianity in particular, and students are forced to regurgitate it. So it's a real problem now, much worse than I recall as a young person, you know, going to high school and college.
So, Andy, yesterday there was an article which appeared in the Washington Free Beacon, and it said, far-left critics of Israel and supporters in the United States have been gaining traction in the Democratic Party for some time, as young leaders such as Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, gain increasing control of the party. Anti-Israel groups, once shunned by mainstream Democrats, are beginning to find themselves welcomed with open arms. The shift was on display Thursday evening when an activist in the virulently anti-Israel, if not now movement, got 2020 presidential contender Elizabeth Warren to promise that she would boycott this year's AIPAC conference, which has attracted top names in both parties for past years. Do Democrats led by members of the Squad and others, do they now set a trend of growing anti-Israel and really anti-Jew sentiment in America amongst the left? I mean, that's really where the anti-Semitism is coming. It's not from far right. It's from the left, for crying out loud, it seems.
It's from this red-green alliance, really. And look at what happened to poor Judge Jeanine for daring to delve into some of that.
Right.
But this is my concern, is that the ability to speak about Islam honestly, and that's what we're talking about. I mean, unfortunately, the religion itself has, and I go into this in just, you know, copious detail in the book. The religion itself is inherently anti-Semitic, virulently anti-Semitic, and an anti-Semitism that's not been reformed in any shape, manner whatsoever. And so, look at how Judge Jeanine was reprimanded and disciplined by Fox News, not by MSNBC and, you know, not by CNN, but by Fox News. So it tells you that, you know, this is a verboten topic across the political spectrum.
Andrew, we got
a little better in conservatives.
We have just a little over a minute left. Your book, it's a very important book. Where can people get it?
It's available on Amazon. I did my best, you know, because I got back to copyright and wanted to republish it myself. So it's 825 pages, but it's available anywhere from, I think they brought it down to $15 per copy. So it's, you know, it's relatively inexpensive. It was the best I could do. I asked for the lowest price they would allow. You know, it's readily available at Amazon as a paperbound book.
Well, it's important work that you're doing, and I appreciate as a fellow Jew, I appreciate the support that you're giving for reason and for you know, discipline and for the right way of looking at the world. We got to take our bottom of the hour break, Andy. Thanks very much. When we come back, we'll welcome advisor to Donald Trump and Fox News contributor Andy Puzder. You're listening to Inside Track. We'll be right back.
This is, I think, of interest to our Inside Track listeners. He made the number three hit list on Bernie Sanders. Andy, was it the most hated or the most...
we call it his enemies list.
His enemies list. Oh, right. But more importantly, he was just named as a senior fellow on public policy at Pepperdine University. That is a great program there, and those students will be very, very fortunate to have you as their mentor. So that's a high, high honor. It's a pleasure, as I said, to welcome you back to Inside Track. We had a lot of favorable comment when you were on the show last summer. Thanks for taking time out for us here. For a very busy fellow, you are incredibly accessible, so I appreciate that.
Happy to do it.
Yeah, POTUS had a pretty successful week, hasn't he? Let's first take his acquittal. How do you think the acquittal will impact his reelect and his legitimacy?
Well, I think the acquittal was terrific, but I think it's the impeachment process itself that has boosted his reelection possibilities or his reelection potential. And Nancy Pelosi and the sort of the never Trumpers, even on the Republican side, have really shown what absurd lengths they're willing to go to reverse the decision that was made by 63 million Americans to elect an outsider to go to Washington, to change the way things are done, to clean the swamp, to make things better economically. He's done all of that, and they continue to go after him, and I think the American people see it for what it is. Independents are strongly opposed to impeachment and removal. Republicans obviously very strongly opposed. So I think people are getting the message here, and I think it'll be a big boost to his potential to come out victorious next November.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that the impeachment affects the president's legacy? There's been lots of talk about this as the conclusion arrived. But what are your feelings about that, Andy?
I don't think it'll affect his legacy at all. I think it was a very, very partisan process. Nancy Pelosi started it by saying it couldn't be partisan. There had to be overwhelming support. This had to be horrendous activity by the president. She went ahead even though she had none of that. I think people will regard it as something that was political. I think she demeaned the impeachment process overall, and she demeaned the Constitution in the process. There's nothing that people on the left, that the Democrats, won't do to try and stop President Trump. He has put the lie to everything they've been telling the American people for the last 50 to 100 years, you know, that they need more government, that they should be more dependent on government, that they shouldn't depend on themselves, that they shouldn't look to the future, look to themselves when they look to their future, they should look to government. All of the, he's putting the lie to all of that, particularly coming right after the Obama presidency, where there was so much emphasis on growing government as a way to help people, and they hate it. They can't. This is terrible for progressives. James Carville came out with an article yesterday, an interview yesterday, where he was saying, look, this is about power. We have to have power. We have nothing. That's the way Democrats think. They don't think about the American people. They don't think about what's best for the economy or people trying to get ahead in that economy. They think about how they can get power for themselves. And I think this president is disclosing that to the American people, and the Democrats hate it.
Yeah. there's been a few legal scholars, most noticeably Dr. Dershowitz, who have talked about how this impeachment will be viewed by politicians and legal scholars of the future. What are your thinkings on how this impeachment process was handled by the House and then again in the Senate, and how that might affect or raise or lower the bar for what an impeachment in a Senate a trial means for future presidents?
Okay, if President Trump wins this next election as resoundingly as I think he's going to win it, I think it's going to be a lesson for political parties going forward that they shouldn't abuse the impeachment process. The Republicans suffered from their attempt to remove President Clinton, and there was actually, he had committed a felony. He committed perjury.
Right, nobody should forget that. Right.
That impeachment proceeding.
Right.
But nonetheless, they got handed their lunch at the polls. You know, it was bad. And if that happens again with this impeachment process, President Trump, I think, contrary to what a lot of people have been saying, I think you actually could see political parties being more careful in the future because of the huge mistake that this turned out to be.
You know, that's really how I viewed it myself, and I'm glad to hear somebody else say it, because there certainly has been a lot of speculation that the impeachment bar has forever been lowered. But I think that something that has been handled as poorly as this one has would have exactly the opposite effect. And I'm glad somebody with your background, you know, has a similar kind of a view on that.
Well, you know, if you were, let's say we're, the Republicans are in power, and we have a president that they don't like as much as the Democrats don't like President Trump. I can't imagine that, by the way. I mean, even with President Obama, in any Republican circle I was ever in, there was a lot of discussion about how we could beat him, how his policies were bad, how could we get him to look at things differently. There was never talk. I don't recall anybody talking about trying to remove him from office, even if he did something that was, you know, that marginally could have been argued he should have been removed from office. I don't recall any discussions like that. But even if Republicans decided to do something like that going forward, I think you'd have to think twice, because, you know, the American people didn't like this. The more, I don't know if you've looked at the Real Clear Politics average of the polling, but they have a graph. They have the polling on impeachment removal. And every time that Adam Schiff and Nadler were on television promoting impeachment, every time there were hearings, opposition went up dramatically in November. It went up again dramatically in December. People didn't like this process. They rejected, I think, the people that conducted the process, and I think we'll see very positive results for Republicans and the president in November.
Well, I think there was a Gallup poll earlier in the week that showed a 49% approval for the president, which was actually his highest Gallup poll rating since the inauguration, and the approval component from the public with respect to whether they feel better or worse about the economy and their own personal financial position was like at 59 or maybe even 69%.
Well, it was 56%, which was a record high.
Yeah.
The last high was 59%, you're right.
Yeah.
And the previous high was 1999, it was 58%. But the more important number for November in that poll was that 74% of Americans feel that they're going to be better off next year. Now, if you think you're going to be better off next year, are you going to vote for some, you know, socialist like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, you know, or some mayor of a small town in whatever, you know, wherever Buttigieg is mayor in, whatever he's a mayor in.
Mayberry.
Are you going to put those people in office? You know, you've got these historically high numbers of people who believe the future is going to be better. You've got the economy hitting just record highs every day. You can't, a day doesn't go by where something new doesn't come out saying how good the economy is and how well the American people are doing. You know, why would you vote in somebody that's going to tear? You listen to the Democratic debates, they don't even talk about how they're going to make the economy better. They don't even talk about how they're going to fix the economy. They talk about how they're going to raise taxes and redistribute income. And if you got a job, that may not be the thing you want to do.
This would be the first election, maybe in modern history, where a winning side is supposed to have a winning play by saying that they're going to raise your taxes and increase spending by $30 trillion.
Mondale tried that back in, was it 86, the election, 86, that's 88. That's 84. Yeah, 80, but anyway, if Mondale tried it, I think he lost 49 states.
Right, it was 84, yeah, I apologize. So, so I don't know how much TV or cable TV you get to watch, Annie, but have you watched the Showtime series Homeland?
I stopped two seasons ago because it started to get really political. It started to have a really kind of leftist tint to it, so... But I watched it early. I watched the early seasons. I thought they were great.
So the past series number six, year six, it really talked about a coup that took place when a Donald Trump sort of like figure was elected to the presidency. And there are days when it really has seemed as though there's sort of this never-ending coup that's been going on against the president. Will the radicals in the Democratic House and Senate ever stop this? I mean, are we done now? Are we on to the election?
Well, the good news is they won't stop. And why do I say that's good news? Well, it's good news for the president because the American people are fed up with this. I mean, you could, again, look at his popularity rating, Gallup 49%. Look at the polling on impeachment. The American people are fed up with this. The problem is that the Democrats' base will never be fed up with this. They will fight and fight and fight to try and take down this president. It's unfortunate. It's not good for the country, but it could have very positive results. Look, there's a chance right now that the Republicans could take back the House, increase the number of senators that are Republicans in the Senate, and keep the presidency. That would be tremendous for the country. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they're going to stop. I think these people are insane. I mean, this Trump derangement syndrome is a real thing. I mean, you just have to talk to some Democrat friends of yours to see this. They can't even talk rationally about the presidency, about the president, about his policies, about the economy. Can't talk about any of it.
Well, I want to switch over to the State of the Union. And somebody who I don't normally equate rationality with is Van Jones. And I watched the CNN response to the State of the Union. I figured I wanted to get the opposing view. That would be the best place to get it. And Van Jones wagged his finger at the host on the panel and said, this should be a warning shot. What the president did was an attempt to reach black voters and Hispanic voters and disaffected female voters. And he said he did a very effective job during his State of the Union speech. Did you hear that comment by Van Jones?
I didn't hear it, but he's right. I mean, this speech covered substance. He covered the numbers, he covered the facts, and it was important for him to do that because the mainstream media ignores a lot of what the president does. For example, the USMCA, the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, the largest trade agreement ever reached anywhere, most significant, and with our number one and number two trading partners, didn't make the front page of either the Wall Street Journal or Washington Post or the New York Times. That's embarrassing. So he needed to cover that. But then he connected all of these policies to people. It wasn't only substantive, it was emotional. You know, he brought in the Tuskegee Airmen. He brought in his grandson. He brought in the girl that was in the fourth grade who's being prevented from going to the school she wanted to go to by the Democratic governor in the state of Pennsylvania. You know, he brought the servicemen back and his wife and their daughter and the little three-year-old son. He really made people feel how these policies impact people. And outreach to the African-American community, outreach to women, his understanding of what they're going through, it all came through. If you didn't tear up during that State of the Union, there's something wrong with you. I mean, it was a very, very emotionally moving and substantively accurate speech.
Now, when that Army sergeant came down the steps and surprised his wife and children, I'm not afraid or embarrassed to admit, I started crying. It was very, very emotional.
Absolutely. And Rush Limbaugh getting the Medal of Honor right there in front of us. Right. I mean, it's, you know, that guy got me through the Clinton administration. I don't think I could have survived if it weren't for Rush Limbaugh. And it was just a very, very, very moving speech. And look, the polling on African-American support for or approval of President Trump is much better than you're hearing. I mean, there is talk in Washington, D.C. that the numbers are coming back somewhere between 30% and 42%, which, you know, this guy got 8% of the vote, the African-American vote in the last election, which was high for a Republican, higher than Mitt Romney got. If he gets 20% of the African-American vote in this next election, the election's over. You know, Democrats can't win if a Republican gets 20% of the African-American vote. And I think the African-American community is starting to say, hey, you know, what have these Democrats done for us? And by the way, since President Trump's elected, I got a job. I'm making more money at that job.
Right.
And I'm taking home more money. I'm taking home more of it because of tax cuts. I mean, who am I going to vote for? You know, there are people out there that can look at these things rationally, and I think you're going to see changes in this next election. November can't come fast enough.
So let's talk about USMCA, the China Phase One Agreement, and the Japan Agreement. I mean, especially in the middle of all of the investigations and the trials and the impeachment hearings and what have you, to get these things done all in the same time. I mean, I'm not just trying to blow the horn for the president, but I mean, it really is quite an accomplishment. And these are impactful treaties, I think. Don't you agree?
Oh, no, these treaties are terrific. I mean, this, the only thing that's been holding back the American economy, GDP growth, has been business investment. Businesses have been reluctant to invest despite the tax cuts because of uncertainty with respect to international trade. This eliminates the uncertainty, and not only eliminates it, but has a very positive infusion. The United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, the International Office of Trade has estimated that it will create about 175,000 jobs and add almost $70 billion to our economic growth. The China Agreement, China's committed to buy $200 billion worth of goods over and above what they're currently purchasing. And in fact, this morning, in order to facilitate that, they made a very substantial reduction in their tariffs for American goods coming into China. So we're going to see a tremendous boost to the economy. The Federal Reserve estimated that uncertainty about trade was reducing economic growth by about 1%. So last year, economic growth was 2.3%. If without trade uncertainty, growth comes in at 3.3%, you know, which would be that 1% difference, that would be terrific for the American people, be terrific for our economy, and it would show what you can do if you have a president with the courage to stand up to other nations, and not only to the Democrats, but to our allies and our enemies, and say the United States isn't going to get pushed around anymore. This is what we're going to do, and come up with a decent agreement.
And the China Phase One deal, you know, it felt to me, Andy, as though it was really Phase One plus, because I hadn't expected some of the enforcement capability that the document has in this first round. Was that a surprise to you? I mean, you're a lot closer to it than me.
I was surprised how much we got done in Phase One. We have, you know, excellent negotiators on the Trump team, and I'll tell you what, any other president, if Barack Obama had cut this Phase One deal and said this was the deal, this is the end, this is all we get, but he cut that Phase One deal, the press would be out there touting this is the most incredible deal that was ever cut by any president or any country in the history of the world. They're only not praising it to the extent that it should be praised because they hate Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But I tell you, can you imagine if Barack Obama had accomplished these two trade agreements, how the press would be covering this? It's an embarrassment to the press, but it should be something that the American people understand. These are incredible achievements. We've got an incredible president, and he deserves our support.
Well, before I get to my last question, because we're getting to the end of our time here, Andy, had Obama actually had an agreement like any of these, Hillary Clinton would have been president today and not Donald Trump, I think.
Do you remember during the campaign when Barack Obama says, you know, this Donald Trump, or maybe he didn't name, he said this one candidate comes out and says he's going to change all these trade agreements. Well, how do you do that? What magic wand do you have? Well, it didn't take magic wands. It took a president with the courage to use tariffs, to use the power of the United States to deal with our allies. It was courage. That was the magic wand, and it was something that was lacking during the Obama years.
Yeah. So the National Prayer Conference or Prayer Breakfast took place, and Nancy Pelosi invoked the Holy Spirit in her prayer for the breakfast. Could you ever imagine a Speaker of the House who would invoke the Holy Spirit in her prayer at the National Prayer Breakfast and be the same person who doesn't just support late-term abortions, but post-term live birth abortions? I mean, you and I think share a commitment to life from cradle until death. But it just seems incredible that somebody who touts her Catholicism the way she does over and over again would take the positions, the radical death decisions that she does on abortion.
I have absolutely no idea how Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden, and I don't want to criticize somebody else for their religious beliefs or how they practice their beliefs, but I'm a Catholic, and I don't know how they can do what they do and claim they're Catholic. This is against all teachings. It's against everything the Church stands for. Even our more liberal Pope is nowhere near Nancy Pelosi's or Joe Biden's positions on this issue. So I think it's hypocritical. It's an embarrassment to other Catholics that these people claim to be Catholic.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andy, thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
It's an honor to have you on the show. I hope you'll come back again. You tell it like it is, and that's what we like here on Inside Track. So thanks very much.
Hey, welcome back to Inside Track. Eb and I here after the interview with Andy Puzder. Obviously, I recorded that the other day. Andy has been very, very generous with his time. You know, he was on Fox News last night, did about a four-minute spot there, and really one of the most thoughtful and thought-provoking guys, somebody that the president really does listen to. I wish I could play for you the outtakes when we do these, because this is our second interview together, the stuff that he shares with me off-air. But he's quite a interesting guy, very, very bright, and he will be a great source of knowledge for these young students that are in the Pepperdine Political Science and Public Policy program. So Eb and I, during the time when we were listening to Andy's interview here the last several minutes, we were chatting about the State of the Union. And Eb, if anybody ever hit this thing out of the park,
oh, he slammed it. From the moment he took the podium,
yeah,
he slammed it.
Yeah. So didn't anybody ever tell these Democratic ladies, you know, they always think of themselves as being so elegant. Didn't
Are you talking about the ones dressed like the KKK?
Yeah, the ones dressed like the KKK. Didn't anybody ever tell them that after Labor Day, you don't wear white?
They don't know these things. Nobody's taught them.
I swear. I mean, how do you, and then how do you not stand for more African Americans working and more Latinos working?
And more women working.
So 72% of all the new jobs last year were got by females sitting on their hands. They were waiting for Nancy
to do her baby shark thingy.
To give them the thing. I mean, it's unbelievable. These women have no mind of their own.
No.
Well, there were some really very, very touching and dramatic parts of the State of the Union. I think the president has taken it kind of to a new level. For me, I think it was the Rush presentation of the Medal of Freedom, and also it was when that Army sergeant came
on down
the
stairs.
That was
great.
That was breathtaking. Nobody knew that was coming, at least mom and her children. And I couldn't help, though, to feel even...
And you know the Dems didn't, or they would have leaked it.
Yeah, of course. Well, that's why, you know, it's like when they went to take out Soleimani. They're upset because the president didn't let him know in advance.
Right.
Really, why?
Exactly.
Okay. Anyway, it was quite an event, and it just shows you the accomplishments. And you know, it was funny because she's like looking over his left shoulder as he is, you know, citing all of these things that she's doing. Her lips, It was like she had like something on her lips. You know,
well, she was adjusting her dentures.
That she was trying to get off of her lips. I mean, she
this
was
portion
just
of
so,
the State of the Union sponsored by Polygrip.
It was just so uncomfortable watching her. A friend of mine actually hung a towel on the right-hand side of his TV screen.
Nice.
So he didn't have to watch her. But it was really, it was part of the, you know, popcorn and soda pop entertainment.
And what really irked me, here he is, he's presenting this little girl with a scholarship. Yep. All the Dems are sitting on their hands.
It's fake.
He has the Tuskegee Airmen.
Right.
The hundred and, how old was he?
102.
Oh my gosh. Number one, the fact this guy's alive is a miracle. Number two, with him standing up there in uniform with his grandson, that was outstanding.
The grandson who wants to be a pilot.
Who wants to be a pilot in the Space Force. And then getting promoted to Brigadier General. Now, granted, that's all symbolic.
I don't know how the heck he did that.
He's the president. He can do anything.
I know. But that was great. He was wearing his Air Force officer's uniform.
Absolutely.
And his grandson from Arizona.
Yes.
It was quite dramatic. And then yesterday with the president's conference, you know, his group setting with all the members of his administration and all, it was a almost surreal, because I remember in 1974 when Nixon had the same sort of thing in that same room saying goodbye. It
yes.
could have just as easily been that sort of event.
Yes.
But the president and his administration hung tough. His defenders hung tough. And look, the basic difference was Donald Trump. You might arguably resist his rhetoric, but you can't deny his results.
No, not at all. You just can't.
And
when he talked about it in the State of the Union, he would say, since I took office, yep. we have. It wasn't about him. It was about the American people. It was about all the accomplishments that the American people have made in that time period.
Right.
And the Dems hate it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're talking now saying, how do we fight this economy? How do we fight what's going on? So the way they're fighting is they're saying, oh, this is because of Obama. Everything that he put in place over 8 years is finally coming to fruition.
Nobody believes that. Look.
Bull spit.
We got to end it here. I hope you'll continue to support our Inside Track, our great advertisers, Imus Wilkin Asset Management, Tucson Iron and Metal Retail, and Corzine Cabinets. Each of these great companies are well-run, local, family businesses. Their profits all stay in Tucson to help the community. I know each of these owners. They love our hometown, and they deserve our support. Until next week, when Tom Danahy will join us on Inside Track,
Eb Wilkinson
and Bruce Ash, wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon and hopefully a Wildcat victory this evening against UCLA. Until then, have a great day.